One of the induction filters on Helmut Sturm's gunship clogged with sand, but the repairs were nearly made, and Sturm agreed with Standartenführer Mann that having encountered no resistance, there was no need to press the advance without rest. The trip up from Argentina was taxing on men and equipment. Helmut Sturm sat now at the small folding campaign desk, a brisk breeze blowing across the sand. Siegfried, his wife's brother, sitting to his right.
Helmut, those aircraft, Americans, do you think?
They're going ahead of us. Whether they run from us or not is another question, but Americans? I think they are not Americans. I think they are Russian, our historic enemy. Man was wise indeed to send along the scouting ships to ascertain their destination. While we rest here, we can prepare ourselves to strike, to destroy them, to crush them. No, all goes well. And it is not Americans who pilot these aircraft somewhere out there. It is Russians, and we shall defeat them. We shall conquer.
He looked at his brother-in-law. The younger man nodded, satisfied apparently. Helmut Sturm clapped Siegfried on the back, Sturm rising.
It will be well to be on the move again, yes, Siegfried?
Yes, Helmut, to press our enemies, to achieve victory.
His brother-in-law was a younger man and did not understand the concept of historic destiny as well as he, Sturm thought. Siegfried was still learning, absorbing. Sturm understood destiny. It was in the faces of his children, in the proud eyes of his wife, when her fingers clasped against the life inside her womb. A master of the earth. Sturm found his cap and pulled it on. A walk toward the fringe of the camp to assay the desert. It was just the thing.
Come, Siegfried. Let us walk, my friend.
The younger man beside him, Helmut Sturm, returned the salute of a subordinate as he walked ahead. Soon the scout ships would return. Soon it would begin again. Helena Sturm's oldest son, Manfred, sat at the head of the table, as he customarily did when her husband Helmut was away with his troops. Helena felt the kicking of her fifth child inside her womb, perhaps her fifth and sixth. There were the more advanced techniques available now. She could easily learn for certain, even find out the sexes of the children. But as her mother before her, she too preferred to learn these as she felt nature intended. Manfred looked up from his sausage and smiled.
Mother, would you pass the bread, please?
Yes.
She took the small basket with the sliced rye bread and handed it to her youngest son.
Willy, pass this to your older brother now, quickly.
As she handed Wilhelm the basket, the clock chimed. She looked across the apartment's largest room to the far wall. It was just 12:30. Manfred was looking at her as she turned her eyes back to the table.
What is it, Mother? You appear agitated.
She made herself smile.
It is nothing, but I have an appointment in 15 minutes. Manfred, can you see that the rest of the sausage is put away and the bread? And
where do you go, Mother?
She licked her lips, watching her oldest son as he stood up, his straight hair falling down across his forehead, his left hand automatically at the scarf of his youth uniform, the sleeves of his khaki shirt rolled up as he was wont to do when he ate, but rolled with perfect neatness, perfect order.
Promise to meet Frau Heider, and we must shop. I don't like to keep her waiting.
She watched her son's smile return.
It is good that a school holiday has been declared while your father and others are away. It is comforting to have your strength during these days, Manfred.
Thank you, Mother.
Manfred smiled, spearing a piece of knackwurst with his fork. Helena pushed her chair away from the table, and Manfred stood again, out of deference to her, she knew.
You sit and eat your food before it gets cold. There's ice cream in the refrigerator. Manfred, would you see to it that the boys have enough, but not too much?
Of course, Mother.
She was already walking across the room, taking up her shawl and her handbag from the small table in the hallway, and opening the purse to make sure she had her key and her money. She had both. She turned, Manfred, visible in the dining area, still standing, still watching after her. She smiled and blew him a kiss.
You boys do as your brother Manfred says, especially you, Willy.
She let herself out and into the corridor.
Oh.
As the door closed, she sagged back against the wall. She realized she was sweating. Helena Sturm told herself it was the pregnancy. She opened her purse, searching it for a handkerchief, clutching the bag against her swollen abdomen as she walked the corridor toward the elevator, mopping her forehead and her throat with the handkerchief, then pushing the elevator call button. Helena pushed the mall-level button and clamped her right hand, still clutching the handkerchief, on the rail. She watched through the glass back of the elevator tube as the car passed downward so rapidly that when she was pregnant, at least, it often made her nauseous. Of course, when she was pregnant, many things made her nauseous. The car stopped, having descended 14 floors. She turned away from the view of the mall-level lobby and walked through the doors, putting her handkerchief away in her handbag, walking across the lobby, nodding and smiling as she saw Frau Doster laden with her books. Helena Sturm reached the doorway to the mall and passed through, the photoelectric eyes opening and closing the door for her. She was on the mall. Helena Sturm looked to right and left, then took her shawl and threw it across her shoulders, walking to her right. She passed the glass panel on the side of the company-grade officer's quarters building, looking at her slightly distorted reflection. She shifted the shawl slightly where it upturned the corner of the big white sailor collar, smoothing the maternity top slightly and walking on.
Oh my, I'll be late.
She reached the crossing area and watched the light shift from amber to green. She started across the street, looking down at her feet a moment as she picked her way. She felt short in low-heeled shoes, but when she was pregnant, wearing higher heels hurt her back. Automatically, as she looked up again, she splayed her fingers along the seam of her skirt. The baby was kicking again.
Oof!
She did not feel it was seemly to massage her abdomen while walking down a public thoroughfare. On the opposite side of the street now, she kept walking, a fleeting wave from a passing electric tram car. Frau Dr. Morgenstern, her dentist. Helena Sturm waved back, not thinking Frau Dr. Morgenstern saw her return the wave because the light changed and traffic began moving again. As she walked along the mall, the posters were everywhere, the swastika, the proclamations of glorious victory. She felt her lips downturn slightly, and she felt slightly guilty. She was a direct descendant of one of the most decorated men in the SS. She kept walking, turned the corner into the shopping mall itself, and walked on toward the mall side entrance to the market. Anna Heider stood waiting for her.
I'm sorry I'm late, Anna.
Anna Heider's eyes were nervous-looking.
I am sorry.
I thought something had... Well, with Manfred and all.
No. Is Eva inside already?
No, she hasn't. Wait.
Anna Heider's blue eyes set. Helena Sturm looked over her shoulder behind her. Eva Mann was running up on her high heels. Helena Sturm felt herself smiling. She remembered when, 5 pregnancies ago, she wore dresses that small and that short.
Eva!
Helena Sturm embraced the younger woman.
Helena, Anna, let us shop.
Eva started inside, Helena falling in step after her. They each took up one of the small computer terminals and one of the styluses and started down the first aisle. Anna Heider spotted something in the dairy case.
Oh, my husband hates cottage cheese. Now is my chance.
Helena watched as Anna's eyes drifted from the displayed container of cottage cheese to the computer terminal in her left hand, her right hand working the stylus to punch the code numbers. They walked on. In the breakfast food aisle, Eva Mann stopped, studying the representative packages.
My husband has very painstakingly rearranged unit assignments, and he feels that the third core is at least 90% reliable. The other 10% can be dealt with.
Helena Sturm licked her lips. She forgot to wear lipstick, and she set down her terminal and her stylus and started searching her handbag for it.
When then?
Eva Mann marked her terminal.
Whatever befalls, the third core will return here for the Unity Day celebration. That is when I told my husband that since he is almost never home for breakfast with the children, he should let the children determine their own preference in breakfast cereal. His mother always made him eat hot oatmeal.
Helena Sturm nodded, not knowing what else to do. Anna Heider turned back to the group.
They're gone.
Helena Sturm glanced once furtively over her left shoulder. The 3 women, wives of party officials, continued down the aisle.
On Unity Day, that is when the leader will be assassinated, and the third corps will assault the SS contingent still here. Once that happens, the 1st and 2nd corps and the Condor squadron will return and declare martial law, and the real battle will begin. But with the leader gone and the SS neutralized here, at least we'll have a chance of holding the complex and drying up their supplies.
Helena noticed Eva Mann was looking at her strangely.
You worry for Helmut and your brother Siegfried.
Helmut will hate me. Siegfried will hate me. Manfred will hate me too, I think.
Helmut is a Nazi, but he is reasonable. He loves you, He loves you and the children.
They began to walk again, Elena looking up to determine the better buy, the 340-gram box of pancake mix or the 510-gram box. As she looked up, she could see the calendar part of the diode timepiece over the checkout counters. Not much time remained at all until the 30th of January, and she was very afraid. But a sense of what was right and what was wrong was something she could not deny ever since she was a little girl. She decided on the larger box of pancake mix. Perhaps her oldest son, Manfred, would be lost to her, but Willie and her two other sons and the life in her womb, they would all know freedom. Helena Sturm started again along the aisle. There was a slight overhang of rock, and Natalia watched the rain, which began, she estimated, an hour earlier. Rain dripped now from the rock overhang. Natalia Anastasia Tiamarovna, naked, wrists and ankles bound to spikes driven into the living rock, her body spread-eagled, shivered. She awoke this way, with no idea how long she had been unconscious, with a burning pain in her back and at the base of her skull. John Rourke taught her to hope. And she did get close enough to kill her husband. But one of the guards intervened before she could accomplish the task. She was still close to Vladimir Karamazov. She knew him well enough to know she would be even closer. The question was to have the freedom of action necessary to kill while she still possessed the strength and will. The desire, she realized, would only grow. She turned her head to the right, her neck aching. It was Karamazov.
You are awake. Excellent. I came to tell you what it will be that you must first endure, so you will reap the full benefit of it both mentally and physically. I shall return in 2 hours. Before I mate with you again, after all these years, you must be purified of this American Rourke, of his taint.
He and I have never...
Yes, you said that before, but I must be sure. In order to purify you, I have chosen a faultless method. A hot iron to burn away all that is foul within you. I think you should find the effect interesting. I have utilized such a device before on women from the wild tribes of Europe, but they were very much like animals, and so the full extent of the reaction, it was difficult to judge.
You are insane, Vladimir! Let the others go. You can do with me what you want then.
I can do with you what I want now. The others? No, no. You still have that to look forward to as well. Watching as Rourke's wife and daughter and the other girl and the black woman are raped, beaten. You powerless to help them. That too should be an interesting effect. Now, you should genuinely enjoy this next part.
She watched as he reached under his black leather jacket, producing a small leatherette case. It was a syringe kit, she knew.
Curious that some good can arise from adversity. A plant I had never known before. It may be some hybrid as a result of the radiation after the night of the war. Or perhaps due to the rigors of the nearly airless climate. It appears to be some sort of mushroom. Well, you know, science was never one of my areas of interest. But it has the most marvelous effects.
She watched, feeling sweat on her upper lip despite the cold, as he withdrew a syringe from the leatherette case.
Only a modest amount seems to induce some sort of condition very similar to paranoid schizophrenia. A total inability to concentrate, all-consuming fear, hallucinations. And it leaves the subject afterward feeling physically exhausted.
He smiled, gesturing expansively with the hypodermic as he brought it closer to her.
I hate you!
Music to my ears, Natalia. Music to my ears.
He moved the needle to her interior left forearm.
If you hate me now, just think how you'll feel in a little while.
She tried moving her arm, but he pinned it against the rock as he stabbed the needle into her flesh. He stepped back. She watched him. A sick feeling spread into her stomach as her body convulsed against her restraints.
No! No!
John Rourke shot his left hand hard against the face of the black-clad Soviet guard, smashing the head rearward against the jagged rock face. The body slumped to the ground. Rourke bent over him, taking up the assault rifle, removing the magazine. He taught himself how to disassemble the new Soviet weapon. He worked the pin, which allowed the action to break open for clearing, then withdrew the bolt. He threw the bolt into the night. Stealth and silence were useful, but not his overriding concern. Speed was his overriding concern. The truck was parked more than a mile away. This was the first of the Soviet guards he encountered. Picking up his own rifle, John Rourke moved ahead along the rocks, his musette bag bulging with spare magazines, the rucksack he took bulging with the guns of the people he intended to save at whatever cost from Vladimir Karamazov. Across his back were two assault rifles beyond the M16 he carried in his hand. The added weight slowed his climb into the rocks and slowed him now as he picked his way forward. But necessity was a more demanding mistress than convenience. He would get his family back soon, but first, another guard to kill.
One less to kill later.
Oh.
Sarah's lips were cut and bleeding from contact with the ropes that bound Akira Kuranami's hands to the spike. But as she sagged forward onto her chest, she smiled. Kuranami was now at work on the knots securing the ropes to her ankles. Her hands were free.
I have them.
Oh.
Sarah Rourke rolled over onto her back, not yet trusting her legs to move. She nodded.
Get Dr. Harvison free. I'll work on Madison after I see how Annie is.
Sarah Rourke crawled on her knees and elbows across the ground to the far side of the tent. Her daughter was breathing more regularly and seemed to be coming around. Sarah didn't undo the gag lest Annie make some loud sound upon awakening. She turned to Madison, her de facto daughter-in-law.
Michael will be all right. Don't worry. He's just like his father. That's his only problem. I'll have you out of these in a few seconds.
She released the gag from Madison's mouth, the girl's head sagging forward, her breathing heavy.
I should have done more.
You tried, and you'll have plenty of chance to once we get out of here if... Oh, my God! Natalia!
Sarah got Madison's hands free. The girl rubbed her wrists.
I can get my own ankles.
Oh, good girl.
Sarah turned, on her blue-jeaned knees, to her daughter as Annie opened her eyes. Sarah reached to Annie's face and undid the gag at the nape of her neck.
Annie, shh, don't make any noise. Are you all right?
What?
Kuranami got himself free enough that I could untie his wrists. We're on our way.
I'm gonna get that bastard that hit me.
Oh, who taught you to talk like that? Your father? A girl your age shouldn't...
Then she remembered her daughter was nearly her own age. To Sarah, the scream was more terrifying than any she ever heard in labor rooms when she worked at a hospital before she married John Rourke, in the camps among the wounded and the dying after the night of the war. It was a scream beyond agony. Annie's brown eyes opened wide and looked up at her as Sarah worked to untie her daughter's wrists.
It's Natalia. We've got to get her out of here, too.
Michael's pulse rate was dropping.
Shit!
Paul Rubenstein picked up the radio microphone, checking the storage battery connections.
Paul Rubenstein to Eden 1. Ground to Eden 1. Over.
This is Jeff Stiles. I'm science officer. Hang on a minute, Mr. Rubenstein. I'll get Captain Dodd. Over.
Rubenstein depressed the push-to-talk button quickly.
Get him damn fast! I got most of the runway cleared. At least one shuttle is to land pronto. I got a man dying down here. He needs medical care and he needs blood. I mean real fast. Over.
I'm getting him, sir. Hang on. Stiles, over.
Paul Rubenstein stood up, pacing the tent floor, waiting for Dodd to come back over the radio.
Come on.
Most of the sand had been cleared, and only one pylon was left from the second bridge. The sand wasn't very much, and there wasn't very much of the pylon either. If he could get at least one of the ships down in time, Michael could be saved.
Dodd to Mr. Rubenstein. Eden 1 to ground. Come in, Mr. Rubenstein. Over.
This is Rubenstein. I gotta get at least one of you guys down here in the next couple hours. John Rourke went off to rescue the rest of his family, Kuranami, and Halvorsen from the Russians. Michael's pulse is weakening and his blood pressure is way down. He needs a doctor and he needs blood fast or we'll lose him. Rubenstein, over.
Mr. Rubenstein, Jeff Stiles appraised me of the runway conditions you mentioned. All clear? Over.
2 hours work, tops, and you'll have the smoothest runway you ever saw. Over.
Then we'll be seeing you. I understand the urgency of your situation. I understand also I may have an attack force of Soviet gunships to contend with when I bring her in. Over.
I've got assault rifles down here. The gunship Dr. Rourke left behind. I can fiddle with the mounts for the machine guns and use them against any of the gunships, or at least try. If you don't come down, the son of a man who risked his life and his family's lives to make a landing strip for you is gonna die. And I wouldn't want John Rourke mad at me. Over.
Mr. Rubenstein, if your Dr. Rourke is off fighting the Soviets, it seems he's doing a job we sort of missed out on the last time, all of us. We won't miss out on it this time. I'm the only pilot of the 6 primary shuttle pilots with combat experience, and I know how to fly choppers. I did that for a while in Vietnam, under circumstances so peculiar, even a 500-year-old man like you wouldn't believe them. Eden 1 is coming down, and if we make it, we'll secure the area and get the rest of the fleet down double quick. I'll begin deorbiting procedure in roughly 2 hours. I should be on the ground in less than 3. Oh, and that other airborne force we've detected? It appears to be comprised of gunships as well. It should be coming your way. It's airborne again, out of Alabama. Dot over. Oh, good luck.
Thanks. Out.
Eden 1 now.
Paul Rubenstein turned off the radio. Then he checked his patient. Michael was feverish, which could mean infection in one or more of the wounds.
I gotta go, Michael. I'm sorry. There's so much to do, and I'm the only one left to do it.
Paul Rubenstein started through the tent flap and ran toward the earth mover so he could complete work on the runway surface and work on the mounts for the helicopter's machine guns. He had to get ready. The thing crawling across her left breast watched her. It was some kind of snake, but it had more legs than she could count and small horns on each side of the head. Its eyes were red, but the face was Vladimir's face, and she knew she was screaming, and she tried telling herself that none of it was real. But the screaming was real, wasn't it? The screaming had to be real, and she could feel the countless tiny feet at the ends of the countless tiny legs as the creature moved across her flesh and she shrieked at it to stop, finally calling it by name. There was another creature winding around the right side of her torso. Sometimes its face looked like John Rourke's face. Then it would snap at the creature with Vladimir's face, and it too would have Vladimir's face. Then the creature would disappear, and with it, the first creature. She looked down toward the rocks beneath her. Snakes and roaches slithered and crawled in a teeming mass. Then from below her legs, there on the rocks, the creature was coming again. Vladimir's face laughed as the creature started up inside of her right calf. All the snakes on the ground were watching her, laughing at her. The roaches piled on top of one another, forming a writhing ladder. The top of the pile crawled under her bare foot. The creature with Vladimir's face was on the side of her right thigh now. She could feel the slime of the wet body as it squirmed against her flesh. The thing was coming closer to her, and she could feel its horned head prodding her and creeping into her. It wanted to mate with her. She couldn't breathe. Her throat was so very tight. The thing was disappearing inside her. She could hear the laughter from inside herself now as the roaches crawled along their living chain and wormed up her right leg. Would they follow the other thing inside of her? She could see inside herself. The horns of the head of the creature glowed orange with heat. The flame consumed her from within. Kurenami to her left, Annie to her right. Sarah Rourke glanced behind her once at Madison and Elaine Halverson. Sarah edged back the tent flap, peering outside. At the far side of the encampment, Sarah Rourke could see Natalia. She appeared naked, her body twisting and contorting as she screamed. Some of the personnel of the compound openly stared at her. Others tried to ignore her, it seemed. Sarah Rourke looked away from Natalia. To the left of the tent, toward the center of the camp, and toward the improvised airfield where the helicopters were parked, stood two men, assault rifles slung lazily across their backs. These were her guards, she realized. She let the tent flap drop back in place slowly.
Two men near us. Each one of them is carrying one of those funny-looking assault rifles, and each one of them has a flap holster with a pistol in it. That's 4 weapons, and there's 5 of us. But each one has a bayonet.
I faithfully practice a kata involving machetes. This would be much similar.
Sarah Rourke looked at the Japanese and smiled. Then she looked at Madison.
Those lessons Michael was giving you? Can you handle a rifle, do you think?
Yes, Mother Rourke.
I want to hurt these men. I can use a rifle.
Then a rifle for you, a rifle for me. Annie, you take a pistol. And Elaine, you take a pistol as well.
I don't know much about guns. If it doesn't work like a Colt...
I'll fix it to work for you.
Fine now.
Sarah looked at Madison.
At the count of three, I want you to shout for help. Not too loudly. I only want those two guards to hear you, not the whole camp. Kurenami and I will be ready. Annie and Dr. Halverson will back us up.
Sarah Rourke picked up the spike Kurenami twisted out of the rocky ground. She hefted it in her right hand, ready.
All right. I'm counting to three. Be ready.
Sarah Rourke raised her thumb.
One, two, three.
Help me! Oh, please! My God! Help me!
Sarah felt a smile. The girl would make a good Rourke. Sarah stepped back, the spike raised in her right fist, held like a dagger, Kurenami beside her. The tent flap opened, the face peering inside. Kurenami's hands flashed forward and the man's body flew inside. Sarah watched as his right hand hammered downward into the Adam's apple of the already supine and very terrified-looking Russian boy. The second guard's rifle came in first. Sarah's right arm arced downward, the spike driving into the man's right forearm. Blood spurt upward as the man fell through the tent flap. Sarah's right hand went for his face, like she had seen it done so many times. The heel of the hand, her forearm straight, hammering upward against the base of the nose. Sarah wheeled half right. Elaine Halverson already had the first dead guard's pistol. Annie tossed Sarah the dead man's rifle, and then his utility belt with its spare magazines. Sarah looped the belt over her left shoulder, worked what appeared to be the rifle's bolt handle, found the safety selector, and moved it to what she hoped was full auto.
Anybody speak Russian?
I do, a little.
This mean pull the trigger and bang?
She showed him the rifle.
Indeed it does, I think.
Sarah nodded. Kurenami had both bayonets now. Annie, the other pistol, and Madison, the other assault rifle. The utility belt that went with it, worn from her left shoulder to her right side.
Ready? We go up the middle to free Natalia. We don't leave without her. Then we fight our way back toward one of the helicopters, and Lieutenant Kurenami flies us out of here. We hope.
Sarah embraced Annie.
Oh, I love you so much.
She placed her arms around Madison. Then Sarah turned toward the tent flap. Sarah Rourke led them on a mission to rescue a woman she should have hated. Natalia felt her body tremble, but the horrible fantasies were gone. Yet what she saw before her was worse. Vladimir Karamazov, a bayonet in his left fist, a third of the blade from the point back, yellow-orange and smoking with heat from a fire on the ground beside him. Another bayonet glowed in the fire.
Cauterizing a wound, my dear.
She felt ashamed of her exposure. She felt this more than fear. And more than this, she felt shame for failing to kill Karamazov, for failing to rescue Sarah, Annie, Madison, Dr. Halverson, and Lieutenant Kurenami. She looked her husband in the eyes.
Yes. Torture me, you sick, shriveled thing. Make me pay for your failings. You couldn't please me, or any other woman. You never could. You never could. Kill me, you wasting creature.
Karamazov extended the glowing bayonet toward her loins.
I'm afraid, darling. Death will not come to you for quite a long time. First, you will see just how shriveled I am.
She could feel the heat radiating from the knife blade. Her mouth opened to scream a curse at him before she could only scream in pain. Her eyes drifted from his eyes to the knife as it moved toward her, millimeter by millimeter, the tip of it singeing her hair. She tried to draw herself back against the rock face, its cold chilling her, the fear gnawing at her.
I have a tape recorder going so I can remember this moment. Forever.
He moved the knife forward. Natalia closed her eyes.
Rot in hell!
She could feel the heat. John Rourke held the python in both fists. He didn't trust the M16 to be that accurate. To kill Karamazov would be easier, but the knife could still plunge forward. He had to disable the arm. His finger moved against the trigger of the Metalifton magnaported Colt, the hammer to full stand. The glowing bayonet sprang upward from his left arm, Karamazov's right hand clamping over his left forearm as Rourke threw himself into a run, the distance between him and the man he so wanted to kill again less than 50 yards. Rourke shot the guard standing beside Karamazov as the man lifted his assault rifle to fire. Rourke swung the muzzle toward Karamazov. Karamazov, seeming to stumble on the rock, skidding, recovering, and running just 25 yards away now, Rourke swung the muzzle of the Python right.
Sarah!
Sarah, an assault rifle blazing from her hands, was running from the far end of the camp, Annie with her, Madison half-walking behind them, firing an assault rifle behind her. Dr. Halverson shot a pistol point-blank into the face of an attacker. The Japanese Kuranami, a knife in each hand, hacked, slashed, and killed his way forward. Rourke looked back toward Natalia.
John! John!
Karamazov vanished into the tumult. Rourke emptied the python into the torso of a man armed with an assault rifle, ready to shoot Natalia. Rourke was beside her now, the big Gerber from his belt slicing through her bindings.
Watch behind me, Natalia.
Natalia's body visibly sagged as Rourke worked the knife against the ropes. He rose, glanced behind him once, and saw Sarah and the others closing toward his position.
Lean on me.
He felt her left arm across his shoulder, limply.
I'm too weak.
Rourke swept her up into his arms, naked, holding her against him, close. He moved her away from the wet rocks and set her down on the ground for an instant, sheathing the spear-pointed Gerber. Rourke slipped the rucksack straps and the slings for the M16 rifles, stripping away his battered brown leather bomber jacket, and easing Natalia up into a sitting position, putting the jacket around her trembling shoulders.
I tried. I almost had him. Someone struck me down from behind, and I woke up.
Worry about it later. We gotta get out of here. Slip your arms into the jacket.
I'm...
Do as you're told.
I can still shoot. Give me a gun.
Better than that.
Rourke shoved the rucksack toward her as she leaned back on one elbow. Sarah, Annie, and the others were holding back the Russians for the moment. Rourke reached into the musette bag slung at his left side for his syringe kit. He saw the mark on the inside of Natalia's left forearm, and he pulled her left arm toward him, swabbing the area from the previous injection with a pre-soaked alcohol-saturated cotton ball. He started to bring the point of one of the hypos toward her arm, and involuntarily, it seemed, Natalia drew her arm back.
Get the shot. Then I've got a big complex for you to keep going.
Vladimir, he gave me some type of hallucinogen. It made me see these horrible things, feel them crawling up inside of me, and...
Rourke looked into her almost surreal blue eyes. They were clearer seeming than when he cut her down a moment ago.
I'm gonna kill him. He's a walking dead man.
Rourke gave her the first shot. He swabbed an area further up her arm. He found a vein and administered the second shot. He bent her arm back at the elbow, the jacket sleeve pushed above it. Pocketing the syringe kit in the musette bag, Rourke drew one of the M16s from the ground beside him, worked the bolt, set the selector at full auto.
Thank you, John. I love you.
Then Sarah was beside him.
Michael, how is he?
Alive, but he needs a transfusion from you or Annie. I gave him two pints, and he's holding on. Paul's looking after him. With all of you here, I had to come.
I understand. Kuranami was going to fly us out of here after we got to Natalia. Why don't you fly one chopper now, Kuranami and the other?
I don't think I could walk far, but I can fly one of those new helicopters. It doesn't require using your legs.
Annie was on Rourke's other side now, one of the Stechkin-type pistols blazing from her right fist.
Daddy, give me some cover.
Rourke fired the M16 toward more of the Soviet troopers. He saw a flash of white passing from his left side and reappearing on his right as Annie and Sarah slid Annie's slip onto Natalia.
What the hell happened to your face?
A rifle butt. I saw the son of a bitch that did it.
Don't talk like that. Who the hell taught you that kind of language?
I saw him when we left the tent. Now he's dead, and I'm fine. And I'll talk the way I want. I'm almost 28 years old, remember?
Yeah, well.
Rourke's shots peeled two men away from Kuranami as the Japanese hacked and slashed with his bayonets.
Let's get the hell out of here.
Rourke rose to his feet, ramming a fresh magazine in his M16.
Annie, take that rucksack and distribute the weapons.
I'll help Natalia get where we're going.
Rourke turned to look at the two women he loved. Natalia looked slightly ridiculous, the brown leather jacket zipped in front and miles too big for her. Annie's slip covering her legs, a double holster rig around her waist, her face drawn, pained. Sarah, wearing her inevitable blue jeans and a faded blue t-shirt, a bandana tied around her hair, was struggling to get Natalia from her knees to a standing position. Both of them looked like beautiful brown rats.
I'll help too. You distribute the weapons.
Rourke's daughter thrust the rucksack into his left hand. She had the belt for the Scoremaster around her waist, and Sarah held the Trapper Scorpion 45 in her left fist. Natalia sagged against her, standing. Natalia's left arm draped across Sarah's shoulders. In Natalia's right fist was one of the L-frames. Madison's right fist held the other L-frame. Rourke grabbed up the other two M16s and tossed Elaine Halverson the rucksack, then put down covering fire for the group.
Your pistol and Kurinami's pistol from spare magazine. Hold on to them.
Rourke dropped the emptied M16 down on its sling. With a fresh M16 in each fist, he started ahead. The three women just behind him, Elaine Halverson and Kurinami bringing up the rear. Kurinami now with a pistol in his right fist, a bayonet in his left. The rain continued in sheets as the wind picked up. Rourke felt the fatigue as he ran, still exhausted from the previous night's work and worn down by the transfusions he gave Michael. Rourke emptied the pistol in his right hand. Then the pistol in his left, and turned to Madison as they ran.
Here, reload these.
All right.
The haggard group dashed through the middle of the camp, racing for the gunships, their only chance of escape.
Your pistols!
Let's roll!
The enemy was disappearing now, and not running from him, Sarah, or the others. He looked overhead. The wind had changed. It was driving straight down, swirling the rain in all directions with hurricane force. He looked up and saw hovering above symbols he thought he would never see again, black swastikas outlined in white. Wolfgang Mann looked at his rank insignia. He resented it. He was a colonel in the Wehrmacht, but his rank was SS Standartenfuhrer.
Attack the Soviet personnel on the ground and in the air. Those others fighting there without uniforms, if they can successfully be captured, do so. But they are not to be harmed. Not yet.
He turned his attention from the teardrop-shaped microphone near his mouth to the controls of the helicopter. He banked the gunship and leveled into a dive for the first attack run against the communists.
Follow me.
He armed his missiles.
Fire at targets of opportunity. Remember my admonition against harming the non-Soviet personnel.
Mann depressed the fire control button for his starboard missiles, discharging the primary tube. First the contrail, then one of the Soviet choppers just starting airborne vaporized in a ball of flame. The windshield wipers were maddening as he stared through his rain-streamed windscreen.
This is Mann. Do it just like that.
He started going for altitude as the rest of the Condor squadron followed in on the targets. If there were other humans alive, humans not aligned with the Soviets, then reason dictated they were Americans. Americans with their lust for freedom. He could use people with such desires to help in his own cause. The troop ships were on the horizon. Mann switched frequencies on the radio and turned to his co-pilot.
Take over the controls on three. One, two, they are yours, three! This is Standartenführer Wolfgang Mann. Third Corps will stay in reserve. First and Second Corps to the ground. There appear to be several women and two men who are fighting against the Soviet force. They are not to be harmed, but taken prisoner, if possible, for my personal interrogation. I repeat, under no circumstances are they to be harmed. First and Second Corps, move out.
He glanced to his co-pilot.
I'll take it again. Release control to me, now.
The possible Americans, whoever they were, seemed to be consolidating their position near three helicopters at the far edge of the encampment. Mann flew over them. One of the women, she looked ridiculous, a leather jacket and a white slip, all that she wore, firing a pistol toward him. A smile crossed his lips. Whoever they were, they could fight. He could use that talent as well. Kurinami already had one of the Soviet machines airborne. Elaine Halverson and Annie rode with him. As Rourke shoved Madison in through the open fuselage door of a second helicopter, he could see Natalia positioning herself in the cockpit of a third. Sarah framed in the open fuselage doorway, firing a Soviet assault rifle.
Keep low! Put down some fire to keep them away as we try to get off the ground!
Rourke started firing the controls, willing the temperature and pressure levels to rise. He pushed open a storm vent beside the pilot's seat, rammed his left fist through it, and fired one of the Scoremasters at the Soviet troops racing past him.
Karamazov.
He lost Vladimir Karamazov. He knew that. But he also knew where Karamazov would go. Karamazov would take whatever force he could spare from fighting the superior Nazi forces and go toward the camp to kill Michael, to kill Paul, to taste the revenge Rourke denied him. Rourke adjusted the mixture, raising the main rotor's RPMs nearly to a satisfactory level. Natalia's machine was getting airborne. Sarah crouched in the doorframe now, still firing into the Soviets.
Hang on, Madison. We got a boogie, sweetheart.
As the bird left the ground, Rourke activated his attack computer, overriding the computerized targeting so he could operate fire control manually. The Nazi gunships were not firing toward Natalia's or Kurinami's craft. Rourke wondered why, but he too withheld fire from the Nazis, seeking a Soviet chopper target as Madison closed the door of their bird. Rourke fired one of the portside missiles. One of the Soviet machines vaporized, a black and orange fireball sending steaming pieces of wreckage plummeting in a cold rain. Rourke, shivering and wet, felt Madison behind him.
A blanket, Father Rourke.
She covered his shoulders with it. Rourke started to tell her to use it, but instead he looked back at her and smiled.
Thanks, Madison.
Nazi troop-carrying helicopters were landing now, men spilling from them, sand-colored khakis, assault rifles in their hands, firing into the surviving Soviets. Other troop ships, still airborne, sent men rappelling from them. Soviet choppers sprayed the lowered ropes with machine gun fire, raining dead Nazis on the camp. More Nazi helicopters closed in, launching missiles toward the Soviet helicopters. On the horizon, Rourke could see a squadron of at least 8 helicopters. They were heading southwest toward the camp, toward Michael.
Natalia, Kurenami, come back if you hear me. Rourke, over.
I hear you, John. Are you all right? Natalia, over.
This is Kurenami. Doctor, you all well?
We're fine. Those choppers that just went over the horizon, we gotta intercept them. It'll be Karamazov, and he's heading to the camp to get Michael. Break off here. Rourke out.
Madison eased into the co-pilot seat beside him. He looked at his daughter-in-law and smiled. Rourke throttled out the pirated Soviet gunship.
Captain Popovsky, signal the attack force to make the best speed toward the campsite and hold back 5 miles off.
Had I killed his son, he would have pursued me throughout the camp after releasing my wife. His son still lives. That is why Natalia came in his stead. He and the Jew were working to save the boy. We will kill the boy.
Comrade Colonel.
What is it?
A message from the underground city. The Eden Project. One of the 6 vessels is deorbiting. Wait, there is more.
Karamazov looked at Popovsky as the young man concentrated on the radio headset.
Comrade Colonel, one of the Eden Project vessels, the one that was making contact with the Rourke encampment in southern Georgia, is about to land. Within the hour, it is estimated. The radio transmissions have been monitored.
Good.
And
with our gunships, we shall destroy Eden 1 as it lands, then kill Rourke's son and Rourke's Jew friend. Then we shall leave the field and rendezvous with our support planes and regroup for a final attack against Rourke and his band.
But, Comrade Colonel, the Nazis, are they not the greater threat to our...
You tread dangerous ground, Popovsky.
Karamazov looked away, studying the pattern of the sheets of rain as they passed the fuselage windows. If he thought there was a god, he would have thought God was crying. And in case there was, he intended to give this god ample reason for tears.
Order maximum speed to the Rourke campsite. We mustn't miss our appointment, Popovsky. Not even by a second!
He rubbed at his injured left forearm, something else for which to repay his wife and her lover, John Rourke. Paul Rubinstein leaned over Michael Rourke, the boy. Paul could not help but think of him that way, despite the fact Michael was chronologically older than he was now, barely breathing.
Don't worry, Michael. They'll be underground soon, and Commander Dodd is your blood type. And a science officer, he thinks he can use the transfusion equipment and give you some of Captain Dodd's blood. You'll live. You gotta live.
Paul Rubinstein stood to his full height, suddenly cold, pulling his olive-drab field jacket closer about him.
You'll live.
Then he bent over the unconscious man to pull the blankets higher across Michael's chest. Paul Rubinstein turned away and picked up his Schmeisser and ran through the tent flap. The rain made the shuttle landing chancier. It would make the cleared highway surface slick for Eden 1.